Chappaqua. Nearly everybody calls it Chappaqua, but it's Chappaqua. For about 4 years, I had an experience that is fortunately comparatively rare and becoming rarer in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was a failure in Alcoholics Anonymous. I came close to being one of the 25% who don't get it. And I know what that feels like in my bones. My failure, which I have understood in the years that followed my final release, which I've understood a little bit, and which I understand better as I go along, I can trace primarily, first of all, to a refusal on my own part to have anything to do with what I called, with a curled lip when I came in, the God business. Not for me. And when I came in, this program worked for me because the fellowship is powerful enough to pull people along even when they reject big portions of this. I rejected the whole central portion of it. I'm amazed. I was dry in here for nearly a year. But as Clarence has stressed this evening, and I'd like to second from the bottom of my heart, if you're real sick with this disease, you don't get well from taking part of the medicine or some concoction that you've made up yourself. This is a suggested program, but if you really want to get well, you better take the suggestions. I rejected the God business and would have nothing to do with it. And even now, I hesitate to touch too much on that. However, I want to start out tonight by touching on it. When this wonderful choir was singing up here, I was reminded, of course, of the parable of the Good Shepherd. The figure, and you don't have to be a Christian to buy this. I guess there are people in AA who aren't Christians. I don't want to sell Jesus to anybody. I'm a Johnny come lately in the spiritual part of this program, and I'm still hesitant to talk about it. But the figure of God is a tremendous figure. I don't mean in the books, I mean in the reality that we've all experienced, because that's what we're talking about here. And I thought as these lovely voices were singing up here, of some of the pictures I've seen painted of God as Savior. In the parable of the lost sheep, I would call your attention to the fact that it's a sheep. It's not the parable of the lost lamb. And the artist always has this lovely picture, and the Savior is walking along, and he has the sheep draped around the shoulders, and the whole thing is very pretty and idyllic. And I believe there's truth in that picture. I believe that in the case of many people whom God the Savior reaches out and brings back, it is kind of pretty and kind of sweet and kind of wonderful. But there's a lot more to the picture than that, and some of us know it. There is a part that isn't so pretty. God the Savior is willing to go into some unpretty places to get his sheep. And as far as sheep are concerned, again, let me say, it isn't a lamb. A lamb is kind of tender and sweet, and you can pick it up easy. But have any of you ever tried to lift a grown-up sheep? Try it sometime. And then try draping it around your shoulders and carrying it any distance. And in the process, try smelling the sheep. Part of this salvation problem is rough stuff. And whatever the power was that reached out and got me, it got me out of an area that wasn't lamb-like, it was sheep-like. I might also touch upon the fact that a sheep is historically and traditionally a stupid beast. Some of us have been pulled back from places that are tough. Nobody gets up here and tells their story. You couldn't do it. Clarence again touched on that. First of all, it wouldn't be right to do it. There are parts of my story That I will discuss with God and another human being in the course of doing the fifth step? Yes. I have to. But I don't want to do it up here. It isn't fit to tell. And there isn't time to do it. What we all do, I think, in one way or another, is to try to bring out the parts of our story that will enable us, first of all, let's face it, help ourselves by bearing witness. I never stand up in this position without feeling that I'm built into this thing as I wasn't before. I think speaking, and it doesn't make a darn bit of difference whether you speak well or ill, whether you speak blithely or whether you stammer, but I think the mere fact of standing up here and bearing witness to it weaves you into this fellowship, binds you into it in a way that you weren't bound before. And I want to be bound into it as closely as I may. First of all, because if I'm ever bound out of it, God help me, I know where that leads. And secondly, again, as Clarence said, it's fun to be bound into this blessed community. I would like to touch just on two things in my experience with this disease, two groups of things. First of all, I have come to see, since I've been released from active alcoholism and redeemed by the power of active in AA, that everything on this earth makes sense. Everything. The garbage on this earth makes sense. The diseases of this earth make sense. There's method in all kinds of madness. Alcoholism makes sense after you begin to be redeemed from it. Again, Clarence said another thing. He said, the Lord has been with us always. I believe that. Looking back on it now, I can see this power, this helping power working in my life, in my struggle with alcoholism, not when I finally got to my knees and said, please help me. I see it way, way, way back in the early part. So I want to go back to the early part, and I want to run through my experience, touching on two aspects of it. First, the aspect of alcoholism which I would call bait. You don't catch any fish without bait. Alcoholics are fish for something. I pursued this thing right into insanity. I was not a little nuts or a little disturbed. I was clinically insane, cooped up for it 9 times. And I pursued it beyond that, very close to death. I pursued it to the point where death, the wrong kind of death, was becoming attractive. And I was not pursuing just nothing. There was bait. Now, an odd thing about the bait in alcoholism, the thing that draws the person on, the thing that is the core of the obsession, the odd thing about the bait is, the only quick way you can describe it is with a Greek word, metamorphic. That's a hard way to say it changes. The bait changes. Let me tell you how it changed with me. The second thing I'm going to cover when I get through talking about the bait are the warnings, and they also change. But first, about the bait. Why did I ever go for this in the first place? Well, when I was in high school, I wanted to be one of the boys. I had a tremendous urge to identify with people. This is not bad, this is good. While I was in high school, I played football and I did some other things, and I sort of was one of the boys, so I was all right in that department. When I got to college, I was not big enough to play that kind of football. And my ambition had changed a little bit. I no longer wanted to be just one of the boys. I wanted to be one of the men. In college, they didn't call you Tom Powers anymore. You were Mr. Powers. I began to develop an itch to be one of the men. And I looked around and I saw that the other 19-year-old men, the one that I was particularly, ones that I wanted to identify with, were drinking. And this was my first motive for drinking. Really, just that. I joined in with guys at the University of Illinois who were locking themselves behind closed doors every so often with a gallon tin of grain, you hope, alcohol, and drinking spiked beer. And at first, my early drinking was very clumsy. I'm afraid my story involves something that, again, Clarence just brushed. I did, in the beginning, a great deal of vomiting. Excuse me, but that's the word for it. I drank my spiked beer, and I got awful sick and awful goofy, and I really snapped my cookies. And after I had been doing this for a little while, I drew one of my fellow drinkers aside, one of the Confederates, and I said, "Look, I know that this is a splendid thing we're doing here on Saturday night, but do you mind telling me just why we're doing this?" And he said, "Yes, I don't mind telling you at all." He said, "I've been watching you." He said, "You're not very good at this. So you haven't learned yet to take it easy." He said, "If you take it easy, in between the time when you start to drink and the time when you throw up, there is a short interval of pleasure." Under his tutelage and with the help of some of the other people, it's amazing there are helpers in this life no matter what you try to do. I learned to capture the short moment of pleasure that's involved, and this was the second part of the bait. So far, I take my experience with alcohol to be utterly normal. I assume, without any experience at all, that this is what the normal drinkers are drinking for, pleasure. It was my second motive for drinking. I began to drink for pleasure, and as I went along, I discovered that a great deal of pleasure was involved. I changed schools. I went to the University of Michigan, and the subject is better taught there. It was 1932 when I went there, and instead of spiked beer, it was near the end of Prohibition, and they were getting some pretty good booze across the river from Detroit, and I began to train on 40-ounce quarts of Spey Royal. Not bad. And I learned to take it easy, to space it right, and I discovered that this stuff enabled me to have a good time. And that was the bait for a while. That's what I went for. Still, I take to be normal. Somewhere along the line, the bait changed again in an important way. I begin to learn that when I had just the right amount of this stuff in me, certain conditions changed. I was changed in another way than the Oxford group means, but changed nevertheless in a way that was very important to me. Ever since I'd been a small boy, I had had something wrong with me that was, I was used to it. I had adjusted to it. I didn't even think of it anymore. But I was afraid of the human race. People made me uneasy. I knew you were supposed to like them, and I didn't. Sometimes sentimental people and preachers talked about loving them, but I thought this is an extravagance, but I knew you should like them. The word for it, I guess, is shy. Every time I got near people, something buckled up all through me muscularly, and I went around doing like this with people all the time, and it was uncomfortable. As I say, I adjusted to the discomfort. And I wasn't really seeking a remedy, but when I ran into the remedy, it was such a delightful thing that it became bait with a capital B. Because when I got just the right amount in me, now too little wouldn't do it and too much would kill it, but just the right amount, people began to change. And I began to think, my God, they're quite passable, aren't they? And later on, they even looked good to me. And then, at first only rarely, but more as I learned to anoint myself just right, I would enter into the illusion that I look good to them. This ran deep, no fooling. It's good for a yuck now, but it was terribly important to me. Here is a good thing in human nature, finding a wrong way. Terribly important, really important. And to give the devil his due, this is not entirely a delusion. People really did look better, and I got along with them better for a while. I have to hurry on here. I'd hate to be stuck with that outlook. The other thing, coming right along here, again, the bait changed, it deepened. I haven't got time to develop this, but when I got to be about 14 years old, I began to look around for what I would excel at. And I was only medium good at football, and it's the only place I had a chance to do anything. I thought, what am I going to be good at? And then I got a high mark in a general science class one time, and that's one of the most unfortunate days of my life, because then I decided I will be good at being smart. And this is almost one of the most unfortunate developments that a future alcoholic can undergo. I decided I would be smart, and I began to apply my smart outlook, my scientific outlook, my you-show-me outlook. I began to apply the notion that I am on the crest of thinking humanity to the religious tradition in which I had been brought up and to which I was heir. And after 3 or 4 weeks, I decided that not only my religion, but all religion was for the birds. Peasants, you know, all right for them, not me. I played along with this. I smart-alecked it for a while. I talked with the rest of the boys that were doing that. But by the time I got to be 18 or 19 years old, I really believed it. I wasn't talking smart anymore. It was in my gut. I did believe that in this entire universe, there is no life, no intelligence superior to that of man. That does an odd thing to a person. I've shared this particular thing with a number of people who have gone that route. Some of you haven't done it, who have lost your faith completely, so that in the center of the being, where the light of faith flashes out, even if a person hasn't any religion sometimes, to have nothing down there, this creates an odd thing. It creates fear. By the time I got to college, and particularly when I got along toward the end and I was getting out and I got married, I was running scared. I was fearful a good part of the time. I was worried a lot. I thought, I'm going to flunk out of school. And then I was afraid they'd fire me from my job. This thing was smoking up and doing what the psychologists call projecting. That's just plastering onto wherever you can hang it. A deep, deep odor of fear. Now, I think that might have done a good thing in my life. It might have finally brought me, at least to my mental and emotional knees, so I could have approached the door of grace. But about that time, I discovered the cure for it. Not only did the magic potion out of the bottle make me better with people, for a time it made me temporarily fearless. And this, again, was bait with a capital B, underscored. And I pursued that bait as my life unfolded. Like a lot of people who are spiritually dead or dying, I had a great need for approval. I needed to be bolstered up in the world. And my wife had to spend a lot of her time telling me what a fine fellow I am. Must have been a terrible bore. And I had to have promotion. And I had to have the boss patting me on the back. And I had to make money, lots of money, not just enough to pay my bills, but enough so that the money I was making said something to me. I needed that kind of affirmation. Looking back on it, I can see how sick it was, but it became my life. I'm drawn on that way. So the combination of that kind of a drive in life, took me into the advertising business. And then from Chicago to Detroit to Cleveland. And I went through a process of falling upstairs. I'm using the booze all along now for the reasons I've given you. In addition to the cure of fear and the enabling me with people, now it comes and it's my friend at the end of the day, And it doesn't have to be too close to the end of the day either, because it enables me to let down after a hard day of this driving. And so I'm using it every day for these not normal reasons at all. Not to be one of the boys, not to have pleasure, but to serve something deeply within me in the wrong way. All of this is the wisdom of hindsight. What it felt like at the time was that, my God, this is wonderful. I really believed in this stuff. I thought, this is taking me places. I am succeeding. I'm making money. Sure, I've been fired a couple of times, but I'm falling upstairs. I get better jobs each time. You know, Irish luck. I'm half Irish, so I had half the luck. But I finally got down to New York in a very responsible job indeed. And now I'm caught in the deadly drawback, which is an inevitable accompaniment of using any drug in this way. Before I got through, I turned into not only a drunk, but a dope. So I know from experience that this works with any drug that you dare use in this way. It gives you what you want. It's terrific bait. It leads you on. You're getting this tremendous result from it. But the ghastly thing is that in order just to keep even with the game, not to make progress, not to have a better life, just to hold it at this level, the dose has to be increased. Slowly, slowly, insidiously, over a period of 4 or 5 years, up, up, up went the dose, until when I got down to New York with a very responsible job, with a wife, and now with a child, I am drinking about a fifth a day. This is just maintenance drinking. I got drunk on weekends. This doesn't set any records, but for me it was a good level portion, and I had to have it. And once in the first year when I got down to New York, I made an important discovery. I knew I was hooked because I tried to knock it off. I was an everyday drinker. I tried for 3 days running to knock it off, and I found I couldn't. And so now the bait changes. The bait is, now I've got to have this stuff to live. And I knew it. I've got to have it to run on. Not just to get away from fear, not just to be right with people, I thought right, but just to function. This becomes like food and water. This is one of the essentials of life, and it becomes more essential, as we all know, even than food. I'll skip just ahead and touch on something I've got to come back to later. Finally, the bait was when my life collapsed all around me and the building came down and I entered into clear-cut and active alcoholism. Then the bait was, I no longer needed it for life. I needed it for a few hours now and then to get the hell out of life. I needed it for oblivion, and I desperately needed it for oblivion. That was the bait. And toward the end, when death was becoming very attractive to me indeed, I needed it. I needed it just to steady me in the place I occupied, where the big chunks of my soul were unbuckling and floating away from me, just to pull me together, not as a body, not as a life, but just as a soul on the edge of destruction. That was the bait toward the end. And believe me, although the bait is no longer attractive, it's damn necessary. Strange business. I would like to mention something that runs corollary with the bait, and that is, from the very early time, the Lord is with us from the beginning. As this process goes on, nobody is really duped into this. There are warnings from the very beginning. One of the very early warnings with me, I've mentioned, going way back to the time when I started, was our friend with the unpleasant name, vomiting. I think vomiting plays a very interesting role in alcoholism. It is the organism speaking to you and saying, you've put something into me I can't hold. I think it's the grace of God talking to a person. I look back over my life, the amount of chucking up I've done, and I think, how could anybody proceed in the face of that? And not only my own chucking up, but the friends who chucked up with me. If there's anything more unpleasant than throwing up, it is to attend another person who is throwing up. There were, in my case, a long series of warnings. And again, this stuff is good for gags, but there's a serious thing in it. I think a person is spoken to by the wisdom, the ever-present wisdom of God from the beginning in this thing. I went through a phase, as we all have done, or many of us have done, where the warnings consisted of unpredictable behavior. I didn't know when I started to drink what I was going to do. I didn't know whether I was going to be agreeable or disagreeable, or witty or morose, or whether I was going to be the life of the party or go home in a snit. Nobody knew and I didn't know. Instead of accepting these warnings, Clarence is absolutely right. Alcoholics are unique people in some ways, and not all of the ways are so pleasant. How could one proceed in the face of this? But carefully, persistently, by practice and endurance, we live our way through this. So that after 3 or 4 years of unpredictable behavior, I reached a point where I got, when I was living in Cleveland, where by golly I could drink and my behavior was predictable. I remember leaving work one night, and I'd had about 8 or 10, and I was glowing like a June bride. And I had just written some advertising that day, which was to appear in the Saturday Evening Post, and I was very thrilled with power. I thought, what a smart fellow. And I could see the evening coming up. And by this time, it came to me, no longer is my drinking unpredictable. I know how this evening will go. If it's dull, I'll drink so much. If it's bright, I'll drink so much. I knew where I was going. I had gotten used to it. I was going through this kind of specious control that we go through, and it's real as long as it lasts. I could count on myself. When the thing broke with me, it broke, as I say, after I got down to New York, in my 29th year. And I went from a person obviously addictive, obviously compulsive and obsessive, but still with an outward facade of normality, right into a smash. I was psychotic. I didn't go into my first institution as an alcoholic. I went in with a label of manic depressive psychosis. And for 2 weeks in there, I was right in with the jumping jacks. And believe me, this gave me pause. I was in the flowing tubs and leather vest department. My associates were an assortment of severely ill people. It is the crudest mistake, the popular saying that the insane are happy. Believe me, they are not. I was mixed up with schizophrenics, paranoiacs, manics. I don't know what kind of a yak I was, but I wept every hour on the hour, and I belonged where I was. I was a mess. I think I might have had a chance to straighten out a little bit in there, but they rushed me around, gave me a lot of vitamins and fresh air, and pretty soon I was taken out of the disturbed ward, and I was overtaken by the alcoholic's worst enemy, health. With the return of health, health fed the alcoholic's second worst enemy, and that is this dreadful capacity that we all, and I do mean all, have, the capacity to lie to oneself effectively. To hoodwink, to cover around with a skein of web, the little spark that never subsides in a person that never stops trying to get the truth through. To hoodwink the truth in oneself, I went back to that. I began to say, well, We advertising people have to have our nervous breakdowns, and I begin giving myself this baloney, and by the time they sprung me out of there, I didn't have a chance. They told me I must never drink again, and I said, yes, I must never drink again. And 2 weeks later, I was drinking again. I drank very carefully for a while, then not so carefully. A year later, I'm back up to a quart a day, and I'm insane again. The first time, I was in a very ritzy nut house. My company was paying the freight. This time, my boss called me in, and he said, well, Powers, we hear that you are loco into cocoa again. And he said, we don't mind you taking a few weeks off to get your buttons sewed back on, but we think that this time, just as an earnest and an indication of your goodwill, you should pay. So I went to a little cheaper place, and they didn't fool around with me so long trying to figure out whether I was an alcoholic who was behaving nuttily or a nut who drank. They gave me the nut treatment right away. And this time it didn't consist of psychotherapy, it consisted of shock treatment. Later on, shock treatment, which is a very useful therapy, and do not let any remarks of mine ever throw anybody off who may need it. I'm not kidding. It doesn't do much for alcoholics, but it does really pull people back who have other types of psychoses. Later on, they developed shock to a point where it was quite humane. They would put electrodes across your forehead here and give you a whack with the electricity, and as you went into your convulsion and shock with people holding you down, if you began to go into the shock consciously, which is very ugly, they would whack you with the electricity again, out you went, and you had retrograde amnesia. That's the Greek way of saying you don't remember anything. So the whole thing is relatively humane, but when they gave it to me, they were pioneering with it. They had not yet discovered electricity. I was given shock each time with just short of a lethal dose of metrazole in the vein while the five guys stood there ready to grab you when the shock took you. I won't try to describe shock. The trouble with metrazole is if you started to go into the shock in full consciousness, it was too bad. They couldn't give you any more metrazole. It would kill you. I had 12 of these shocks, 3 a week for 4 weeks, and I was fully conscious in 8 of them. I to this day don't know what that did for me. Physically, I used to just feel all beat up afterwards. Mentally, well, who could tell? The whole thing was so confused. But for the first time in my life, when I came out of the 12th shock, they had to carry me into it because I had such a horror of this experience I couldn't stand on my feet to walk in the treatment room. I think for the first time in my adult life, I had acquired a little humility. There was a nice doctor who looked at me over his steel-rimmed glasses and said, Powers, we have done our best for you in the nuts section and we are not encouraged. But shall we now discuss your alcoholic problem? And I said, yes, sir. Please, let's do. He said, why don't you go over to White Plains and identify yourself with a group of people over there who call themselves Alcoholics Anonymous? And I said, that wouldn't be for me. And he said, why is that? I said, well, this was described to me in the Hartford Retreat a year ago, and I couldn't do this. And he said, well, do you mind telling me why you couldn't? I said, no, I don't mind telling you. It's because I'm too intelligent for that sort of thing. And he said, well, how does that play? And I said, well, this thing, as it's described to me, it's got a God angle, you know? Come to Jesus, son of prayer. And I said, well, after all, I've been educated in 2 universities. I said, doctor, we intelligent people, this is rapport between patient and doctor. We intelligent people have to solve our problems, don't we, without recourse to these primitive superstitions? And here was a kind man with the grace of God in him, and he looked me right in the eye in the sweetest way, and he said, Powers, I realize, and all of us do here, who've had you under observation, that you are a brain. But he said, we've had the brain in the tank here now twice. and it still does not look good to us. So he said, why don't you, just in the interest of science, go over there to White Plains and... go over and jump into the sawdust with these characters and see what happens. So I went to my first AA meeting, and again, although it's good for yucks, years later, at that time it was a matter of unrelieved seriousness to me. I remember saying to myself one time when I was in the nut house, they took me out with a keeper to walk, and I remember saying, you have not laughed for a long time. One of the things about mental illness is that there are very few laughs in it while you are in it. I went to my first AA meeting with one thing in my favor. I really, by God, now wanted help. And I sat and I listened. And there was something in that meeting. Look, this, what I'm about to try to talk about, is a very simple thing. You all know what it is. It's just that I don't know the word for it. I have never been to an AA meeting where I didn't feel it. You can call it what you want to. Reality, I would call it authority. There's something here that's real. I don't care what your philosophy is. If you're half open, if you've got a little corner of yourself open, there is a power here which isn't yet metaphysical, and it may not even yet be God, but there is a power in Alcoholics Anonymous, an astonishing power to reach out through a person's fear, through a person's broken mind, and get to them. That happened to me in the first meeting. I left there, I heard four people talk, I knew just as sure as I'm standing here several things. I knew those people were sick in the same way I'd been sick, and I knew they had an answer. And that was a very important thing to me. Then I came back for more, and more, and more. And the weeks went on, and they turned into months, and I continued to go to meetings. And they got me out running around helping other people, what is erroneously, as Clarence has mentioned, 12-step work. And by God, at the end of 6 months, I'm as sober as a judge and have been all along, and it isn't much of an effort. And I'm liking it and enjoying it. I was sober almost a year. Somewhere in the course of that, you see, I was sober on a free ride. There is a kind of momentum to this thing. Don't mistake the free ride in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the gift. God's grace is something nobody understands. But apparently the Almighty is concerned with rearing free chickens here to try to bring up free sons. And in AA there is a kind of thing just in the group, just what goes on here, that will pick anybody up if they half mean business. And you're carried along as if you jumped in a river. Only this river goes to health and life instead of over the falls and down to death, the way the river of alcoholism goes. You get a free ride. I can't speak for anybody else. I did. And I think I see a lot of other people getting the free ride. Here's where a mistake can be made. The citizen is apt to think, well, 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 look how good I'm doing. This is what I thought. And about the time when I might have started to chew on the God business, I began to think, no, I'm doing all right. Am I not? My health was getting better. My job was in good shape. My home life was improving. I could even smell the leaves and the rain. I was waking up. I thought, I'm doing all right on this thing on my own. And then I began to think, well, this is a new movement, you know, and all movements have a crude stage, and this God business is just a little fluff on the side. As this thing goes along, intelligent people will show up in it. You know, a few are already showing up. And we will see through this God business. And we won't say anything to upset, you know, the people that have to lean on that sort of thing. But in the midst of it, there will evolve a kind of high AA of the brain. I could see myself playing a very quiet but effective part in this development. And then I began to miss meetings. You have to do this, you know. It's not easy to slip, and what I had in the end was not a slip. It was a relapse. But if you're going to have either a slip or a relapse, don't think you can just step off someday and take a drink. This program is stronger than that. You've got to edge your way out. You're surrounded by friends who may prevent you. They may grab you by the lapel someday and say, hey, Powers, you aren't making any sense, and you wind up back in here still sober. If you want to slip, you have to ease out slowly enough so nobody notices too much. I missed a meeting here, a meeting there, and I began to think in the back of my mind that I will drink again. I'm not so foolish now as to think I can get away with it, but I thought there was just a chance I might. And if I didn't, I would do what so many slippers have done. I would come back and have some more AA. It looked like a sure thing. So one day, not slipping, not falling, not swept away, I deliberately tipped up about half a tumbler full of Canadian Club and put it down. 6 weeks later, they were after me, not a year later, with the net. And I got back to AA just in time. But then I made a very nasty discovery. I sat in the back of the room. I was all puckered up to be humble with my little plate of crow, you know. I'd just all thought out. I even, as the meeting went along, I thought, well, in another 3 months, they don't let people talk up our way until you've been dry for 3 months. I'll be up there telling them again about my slip. The only trouble with that is the next day I drank again, and that one I didn't plan and I didn't intend, and it scared me. And I came back not to my customary 2 meetings a week, but 3 or 4 meetings a week. And I stayed dry 2 weeks, and then I got drunk. And then I went to a lot of meetings, but I got drunk again. And then the weeks turned into months, and the months went on, and finally it became clear to me, as I continued to drink, that I was now outside of this fraternity. I went to meetings. I tried to talk to people. I tried to say, what's the matter? But I still continued compulsively, obsessively, not intending to, not wanting to, and finally desperately not wanting to, but again, drinking because I had to. It's a long story. I just can't begin to develop it. I got back into AA 4 years later. 7 more nut houses. In the meantime, I turned, as I have told you, into a dope. I took my tolerance for booze backed up 5 or 6 drinks, and I was a crazy man. I would never think. I'd go right out of my mind with the booze. I would never think of starting a drunk with just a pint. It had to be a pint and a big fistful of Nembutal or something. Nembutal, Amitol, Seconal, Iprol, you name it, I took it. Anything I could get my hands on. There was no more money for a bug house every other week. I wound up in the county place when they would take me. The last 2 of those 4 years, I was completely unemployable. I turned into a short-term periodic out of fear. I was no longer an everyday drinker. I would go a week and then get drunk, 2 days and then drunk. I had a 3-month jinx. I could never get past it. Again and again and again, I would get dry enough so I think, my God, maybe I got it. And then again, I would fail. I begin to have what the doctors call anxiety, a very poor term. The German name is better, Angst. It's a kind of anguish of soul. I begin to get these terrific seizures of fear, even after I had been dry for weeks. And I was unemployable because I couldn't get on a commuting train and go to New York to look for a job, because I would break out in the sweats and the horrors on the train and get around and get off in Grand Central and call up home and say, for God's sake, meet me at the station. I can't make it. Meantime, through this all, I did one thing. There was one little spot of sanity. I kept coming around AA. I hated to come. I hated the guts out of coming, but I had to. Because there was enough spark of sanity in me so that through it all, I knew what was wrong with me, I knew what I had, and I knew there is an answer here. I never lost it. I kept coming back. I sat out in the meetings there and listened to speakers and full of resentment. I hope those of you who have been in here and never been off it never have that experience. To be immersed in this thing, knowing you need it and yet not be in it, and hating and resenting the people that have got it. It's a weird experience. And yet I had to come back hoping in the midst of this sick mind that someday it might be given to me again. I got it again, I think, as a result of something that happened to me in Gotham Hospital on Easter Sunday, in the week following Easter Sunday, 1946. I was hauled in there by two friends, and I was right in the DTs. I don't mean the SWATs or the RAMs, I mean really in them. And I had a full course of them, 4 days, and I was loaded with chloral hydrate. And when the chloral wore off, and I started to come out of the DT, I hit something that people sometimes do in coming out of a bad case of DTs. I've talked to a few other guys who have done this. There are periods of almost abnormal clarity. And in those periods, I got to look at something that I never expected to see, because I thought I had been seeing it all my life. I got to look at myself with the false face off. I saw what I am underneath this structure I had built on top of myself. All of these acts, the brain, the wise guy, I suddenly saw how absurd that was. I saw there was a time when I never had that face on me, and there would be a time again when I wouldn't have it. The successful businessman, this whole mechanical series, some of these faces are useful. They're not bad. Some of them are desperately bad. But it was just as if a series of masks were ripped off me, and I saw what was underneath it. And it's a simple thing. It is very much like a small child. Maybe it is a small child. Maybe the small child in each of us is not buried back there in the past. Maybe we bear this thing in our breast. Maybe this is what Christ was asking us to do, return to it. Because it knows. It doesn't have to be taught. It knows what every child knows. You don't teach children about God. Children know. And I suddenly knew in that time, not as a speculative matter or a matter of the mind, but as a matter of the heart. I knew that everything I had heard in AA from the beginning was simply true, and that our program is tremendously summed up in the third and the 11th step. And whatever the names for it are not terribly important at the level we have to make connections, but the fact of it is immensely important, that there is in this world a higher power upon which all people are dependent, just for their ability to breathe and keep the blood moving through their bodies. And we alcoholics, deeply and desperately, and in the end so wonderfully dependent for our return to life. I wasn't sure after that I would make it again, but I thought I might. I came back to my meetings and they were easier to sit through. 1 month, 2 months, I got by 3 months. I took a terrific breath. 4 months, 5 months, 6 months, and then I entered into a period where I didn't dare say to myself or think, even think of it. I clung to the 24-hour program. I didn't dare think, I'm making it. I'm coming back again. I was afraid to think of it. I was so, so scared of another failure. And then one night, I guess I'd been dry a little over a year, I was sitting in a meeting and I wasn't asking whether I had it again. I was in a state of quiet. And it came to me gratuitously out of nowhere. I knew I was back again. I don't mean that I've got it made. Nobody has that. But I knew I was in this thing again. I was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous again. And I had again what everyone has here who is a member. And never underestimate what it means to be a member. God, your hand is a member. That means something that belongs. Chop it off and what is it? It's a piece of meat. I was a member again. And I had, and there is no other explanation for it, this utterly miraculous protection against a deadly and terrible enemy. Thank you.